Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 123. It's Monday, July 19th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, I took a week off the show and hadn't done recent news, and sure enough, over the last couple weeks, COVID cases nationally have gone up about 240%. Yikes. Well, folks, the U.S. has never gotten below a seven-day average of 10,000 cases per day, the case that the feds were considering to have a controlled epidemic in this country. And I haven't looked at cell phone data for a while, but I took a look at that, and wow, we are back to pre-pandemic levels of travel and encounter density. And the Delta variant thanks us. Well, on NPR this morning, I heard a very interesting commentary, which I think about summed it up. Most unvaccinated people will likely eventually get infected, and for most people, this will be the worst viral infection they will ever get. If there's anything we've learned in this pandemic, is that viral infections matter. Okay, well, let's get on with the news, and unfortunately, it's being dominated by COVID-19. This from The Hill. CDC director warns of a pandemic of the unvaccinated as cases rise. The CDC director warned of rising cases last Friday, stating that COVID-19 is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated and that vaccinated people are protected against severe disease. The country is averaging over 26,000 cases per day, nearly a 70% increase from the previous seven-day average, Walensky said. Hospitalizations are also up to about 2,800 per day, a 36% increase from the prior week, and deaths are up 26% to 211 per day. But almost all the hospitalizations and deaths are among unvaccinated people. Walensky said 97% of people entering the hospital with COVID-19 are unvaccinated. And actually, the number of people, the proportion of people that die is over 99% of those people that die of COVID-19 are unvaccinated. Woo! That's a good reason to get vaccinated, folks. Well, these dire realities do seem to be affecting public opinion in some way. This from The Hill. Poll shows growing worries about Delta variant. Americans are growing increasingly concerned about the Delta variant of the coronavirus and are split along party lines on President Biden's handling of the new strain, according to a new poll. A CBS YouGov survey published over the weekend found 62% of Americans saying they're concerned about the Delta variant, now the dominant strain in the United States, including 48% of people who indicated they are not vaccinated. 72% of vaccinated Americans say they are concerned about the Delta variant. Of the respondents who said they are not vaccinated, 53% listed worried about side effects as their reason for declining to get the shot. Along partisan lines, 57% of Republicans said Biden is focused too much on getting people vaccinated. Only 35% of Democrats said the same thing. 84% of Democrats said they are or plan to be fully vaccinated, as opposed to 62% of Republicans and 67% of independents. Nearly 30% of Republicans polled say they will not be vaccinated. And this from the New York Times. After a steep plunge in virus cases, every state is seeing an uptake. I'm going to repeat that again. Every state is seeing an uptick. the number of new coronavirus cases increasing in every state, setting off a growing sense of concern from health officials who are warning that the pandemic in the United States is far from over, even though the national outlook is far better than during previous upticks. The 160 million people across the country who are fully vaccinated are largely protected from the virus, including the highly contagious Delta variant, scientists say. In the upper Midwest, the Northeast, and on the West Coast, including Chicago, Boston, and San Francisco, coronavirus infections remain relatively low. But the picture is different in pockets of the country where residents are vaccinated at lower rates. Hotspots have emerged in recent weeks in parts of Missouri, Arkansas, and Nevada, among other states, leaving hospital workers strained as they care for an influx of coronavirus patients. Less than a month after reports of new cases nationally bottomed out at around 11,000 a day, virus cases overall increasing today with over 26,000 new cases a day, and hospitalizations are on the rise. The country is at an inflection point, and experts said it was uncertain what would come next. While nationwide cases and hospitalization numbers remain relatively low, more local hotspots are appearing, and the national trends are moving in the wrong direction. Many of the oldest, most vulnerable Americans are already inoculated, but the vaccine campaign has sputtered in recent weeks. This will definitely be a surge, said Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. It won't be as big as what happened in January, but we still have 100 million people in the United States who are susceptible to COVID-19. A slowdown of the vaccination effort has amplified concerns. About 530,000 people are now receiving a vaccine each day, a sharp decrease from the 3.3 million shots a day in April. Less than half of the United States population has been fully vaccinated. And daily case numbers have increased in all 50 states, including 19 states that are reporting at least twice as many new cases a day. And from the Washington Post, Delta variant takes hold in U.S. as coronavirus cases rise nearly 70% in last week. Federal health officials sounded an alarm Friday about a surge in U.S. coronavirus infections fueled by the twin threats posed by the highly transmissible Delta variant and a stagnation of efforts to vaccinate as many Americans as possible. There is a disproportionate burden borne by some states. Florida emerged as a national hotspot, accounting for 1 in 5 cases in the past week. 4 states were responsible for more than 40% of cases in the past week, health officials said. And 10% of counties have moved into the high transmission risk category. Florida, where only about 47% of the population is fully vaccinated, ranks 26th among the states in vaccinations, according to the CDC's vaccine tracker. The slow vaccine rollout, combined with a reduction in people wearing masks, made the large and populous state a ripe ground for the emergence of the Delta variant, said John Brownstein, chief innovation officer at Boston's Children's Hospital. The concern for the South is the summer months bring people indoors because of the heat. Mary Jo Trepka, an infectious disease expert at the Robert Stemple College of Public Health and Social Work at Florida International University, has been tracking the rising cases from week to week and is also seeing an increase in the percentage of people testing positive. The current surge, she says, feels uncomfortably familiar. It's almost the same timeline as last year, Trepka said. She's hoping it won't prove as steep. Figures from Florida's health department show that in the past month, the number of cases is 4 times higher, reaching more than 45,000 per day in the most recent week. 45,000 in the most recent week. A week ago, the rate of cases in Miami-Dade County was 150 per 100,000, or 5 times the rate of the United States. What's most worrisome, Trepka said, is the stalling vaccination rate. It's not too late to get the vaccine. Vaccination rates are particularly low in some rural counties in northern and southern parts of Florida and in the Panhandle, according to Cindy Prinz, an epidemiologist at the College of Public Health and Health Professions at the University of Florida. Prinz also noted that people are acting as if they are done with the pandemic. There is a feeling of being open, Prinz said, particularly following the 4th of July. It doesn't have to be, Prinz said of the new surge. If people would get vaccinated, we wouldn't be seeing these numbers. And again, remember, while the vaccinations is the route out of this pandemic, it also depends on all the other things, the quote, non-pharmaceutical interventions like social distancing and mask wearing, washing hands. Those type of things are still important and provide layers of protection. And the fact that we're basically back to pre-pandemic behaviors allows this new, more highly transmissible Delta variant to run rapid through unvaccinated populations. It ain't over yet. This from The Hill. COVID-19 cases surge in Nevada as federal government prepares to send help. Coronavirus cases are surging in Nevada as the federal government is preparing to send help to the state for vaccination efforts. The state's average new cases a day, hospitalizations, and positivity rate are all at their highest level since February, as almost half of the state's population who qualify for the vaccine have not received it, state health officials said last Thursday. The Nevada Health Association said the reason for the outbreak, which has taken part in the unvaccinated population, is that those people are not wearing masks or social distancing. Individuals are not following CDC guidelines related to mask wearing for unvaccinated persons or maintaining social distancing in crowded indoor locations. And remember, folks, this is a pandemic worldwide. This from Medical Express. UK government plan to end virus orders queried as cases top 50,000 per day. The UK recorded more than 50,000 new coronavirus cases for the first time in 6 months last Friday, amid a warning from the British government's top medical advisor that the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 could hit quite scary levels within weeks. Despite the increase, the British government today lifted all remaining legal restrictions on social contact in England and to ditch social distancing guidelines as well as a legal requirement for people to wear masks in most indoor settings, including shops, trains, buses, and subways. The government's hoping that the rapid rollout of vaccines will keep a lid on the number of people becoming seriously ill, a stance that some leading international scientists at a, quote, Emergency International Summit critiqued as, quote, reckless. The scientists warned that the combination of high infection prevalence and high levels of vaccination create the conditions in which an immune escape variant is most likely to emerge. And elsewhere in the world, from Medical Express, Africa COVID deaths surged 43% in a week, says World Health Organization. Coronavirus-linked deaths in Africa surged by 43% in the space of a week, driven by a lack of intensive care beds and oxygen, the World Health Organization said last Thursday. The agency's regional director, Machadisu Moeti, told a virtual press conference that the rise was, quote, a clear signal warning that the hospitals in the most affected countries are reaching breaking point. It was crucial for countries to beef up oxygen production to help patients suffering from the disease's worst symptoms, she said. The World Health Organization said the rise in deaths paralleled a chronic shortage of vaccines, a spread of the more contagious Delta variant, along with public fatigue over prevention measures. Separately, after talks with the World Bank last Thursday, African leaders appealed for at least $100 billion in commitments of financial support by year's end to help their countries recover better from the pandemic. Less than 3% of Africa's total population has received a first dose of vaccine, compared to around 54% of the United States and the European Union. And also from Medical Express, Indonesia is the new epicenter of COVID-19 in Southeast Asia. With the exception of Singapore, Southeast Asian countries have recorded unprecedented spikes in daily case numbers and deaths during the last several weeks. In April 2021, Thailand recorded an 8-fold increase in 7-day average daily new cases. The trend in the last few weeks have been worse. Malaysia's 7-day average daily new cases per million population more than doubled between May 1st and July 11th. With a population nearly 10 times that of Malaysia, Indonesia has recorded an almost 7-fold increase for the same parameter from May 1st to July 11th. Indonesia's daily case numbers for the last few days is breaking records without a significant increase in test numbers. Indonesia is now considered Asia's new COVID-19 epicenter, overtaking India. What has prevented Indonesia from showing a similar spike with India during its worst days in terms of incidence rate per million population was simply the country's low test coverage. The increase in case numbers has been followed by spikes in deaths as well. And back to the U.S. from Medical Express. U.S. Surgeon General issues call to counter urgent threat of vaccine misinformation. U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy last Thursday called on tech companies, healthcare workers, journalists, and even ordinary Americans to do more to fight vaccine misinformation. In a 22-page advisory, Murthy wrote that false claims have prompted people to reject coronavirus vaccines, masks, and social distancing, undermining threats to end the coronavirus pandemic and presenting a, quote, urgent threat to public health. The warning comes as the pace of COVID-19 vaccinations has slowed throughout the United States, in part because of vaccine resistance. Murthy, who also served as Surgeon General under President Barack Obama, noted that Surgeon General advisories have typically focused on physical threats to health, such as tobacco, but misinformation about COVID-19, deemed an infodemic by the World Health Organization, can be equally deadly, he noted. Given the role the internet plays in spreading health misinformation, Murthy said technology companies and social media platforms must make meaningful changes to reduce its spread. Too often, he noted, the platforms are built to encourage, not counter, the spread of misinformation. Murthy also called on teachers to expand lessons on media literacy and critical thinking. Journalists should work to responsibly debunk health misinformation without inadvertently spreading it further, he added. And public health professionals should do a better job explaining why public health guidance can change as new information arises. Murthy's message of urgency extended to everyday Americans. He urged all citizens to verify questionable health information with trusted sources like the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and to exercise critical thinking. If people have loved ones or friends who believe or spread information, he said, it's best to engage by listening and asking questions, rather than by confronting them. Misinformation hasn't just harmed our physical health. It has also divided our families, friends, and communities. The only way to address health and misinformation is to recognize that all of us, in every sector of society, have a responsibility to act. And this from The Hill, Biden, social media platforms, quote, killing people. President Biden last Friday said that social media companies that allow coronavirus misinformation to spread on their platforms are, quote, killing people. Escalating a fight with Facebook and other companies as the White House warns about the spread of inaccurate information about COVID-19 vaccines. Biden was asked by reporters at the White House on Friday afternoon what his message is to social media platforms on coronavirus misinformation. They're killing people. The only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated, and they're killing people, Biden said. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued an advisory last Thursday labeling health information an urgent threat amid the Biden administration's push to get more people vaccinated. Murthy said that misinformation is among the range of reasons why some Americans are not getting vaccinated against COVID-19, despite vaccinations being widely available. The White House is asking Facebook and other social media companies to be more aggressive in removing harmful posts that spread disinformation and flagging posts that spread information, according to White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. We are regularly making sure social media platforms are aware of the latest narratives dangerous to public health, and that we and many other Americans are seeing across all of social and traditional media, and we work to engage with them to better understand the enforcement of social media platform policy, she told reporters on Friday. The time has come. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. And with that, this from CNN. Fauci says polio would still exist in the U.S. if the false information currently being spread existed decades ago. If the health misinformation currently spreading regarding coronavirus vaccines existed during the days of polio, it would never have been eradicated, Dr. Fauci, President Joe Biden's chief medical officer, said last Saturday. Asked by CNN's Jim Acosta about the misinformation spread by Fox News regarding the COVID-19 vaccines, Fauci said, "We probably would still have polio in this country if we had the kind of false information that's being spread now." He added, "If we had that back decades ago, I would be certain that we'd still have polio in this country." The statement comes as dangerous falsehoods about COVID-19 vaccines are swirling, and as health experts warn of the more transmissible Delta variant increasing spread among unvaccinated Americans. Nationwide vaccination rates are dropping. While in 46 states, the rates of new COVID cases this past week are at least 10% higher than the rates of new cases the previous week, according to recent data from Johns Hopkins University. Among those states that have fully vaccinated less than half of their residents, the average COVID-19 case rate was 11 new cases per 100,000 people last week, compared to 4 per 100,000 among states that have fully vaccinated more than half of their residents, according to a CNN analysis. If you look at the extraordinary success of eradicating smallpox and eliminating polio for most of the world, and we're on the brink of eradicating polio, if we had had the pushback for vaccines the way we're seeing on certain media, I don't think it would have been possible at all to not only eradicate smallpox, we probably would still have smallpox, said Fauci. Polio once was a common virus. In some young children, it can affect the nerves and cause muscle weakness and paralysis. There is no treatment and no cure, but getting vaccinated can prevent infection. Just in August 2020, polio was eradicated from Africa after governments and nonprofits had worked since 1996 to eliminate the virus with sustained vaccination campaigns. Polio has been eradicated in the Americas, Southeast Asia, Europe, most of Australia, and in Africa. Wild strains of polio circulate now in only two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And to get a further idea of how much vaccines have changed our lives and prevented so much death, this from Medical Express. Vaccines given in the last 20 years could prevent 50 million deaths. Vaccinations given in low and middle income countries in the last 20 years will prevent 50 million deaths from infectious diseases. New research led by the Vaccine Impact Modeling Consortium, including researchers at Imperial College London, assessed the impact of vaccination activities against 10 infectious diseases across 112 countries. The team says that success is expected to continue, with a further 47 million deaths predicted to be prevented by vaccination given between 2020 and 2030, if progress is sustained. That could mean 97 million less deaths in low and middle income countries that would be prevented by vaccination occurring between 2020 and 2030. The majority, 52 million of deaths averted, would be children under the age of 5. However, the research warned that COVID-19 has disrupted vaccine activities and could lead to a decline in coverage. If vaccination efforts continue as planned until 2030, the team estimates that 47 million deaths from measles would be averted. The next highest was hepatitis B with 29 million deaths averted, and HPV was third with 6.6 million deaths averted. And for some insight in what's happening in America, this from The Hill. Americans' confidence in science split heavily along party lines, says Gallup poll. American confidence in science has split heavily along party lines, according to a Gallup poll released last Friday. The survey found that Democrats were very confident in science, with 79% saying they have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the field, compared to just 45% of Republicans who said the same. Among independents, 65% expressed confidence. The gap between Democrats and Republicans was the widest of any institution measured in Gallup's polls this year. This is really important, I think, for all these institutions, many of which have high levels of trust and low levels of trust. The gaps between Republicans and Democrats, there are some, but this regarding science, a basic institution of science, is the widest of any institution measured in Gallup polls this year. The last time Gallup polled Americans on their confidence in science was 1975. GOP confidence in science is down 27 percentage points since then, compared with a 12% increase among Democrats. Confidence declined 8 points among independents. According to Gallup, the lack of confidence among Republicans may stem from conservative leaders' allegations of liberal bias in the scientific community. It also tied the mistrust to issues surrounding COVID-19 vaccinations. Overall, 64% of Americans said they have confidence in science. Yep, perhaps the problem is, as Stephen Colbert says, is that reality has a liberal bias. But this isn't quite the case across the country. This also from Medical Express. Study finds vaccine hesitancy lower in poorer countries. New research published in Nature Medicine reveals willingness to get a COVID-19 vaccine was considerably higher in developing countries, with 80% of the respondents willing, with United States at 65% and Russia at 30%. Personal protection against COVID-19 was the main reason given for vaccine acceptance among low and middle income respondents, 91%, and concerned about side effects, 44%, was the most common reason for vaccine hesitancy. Health workers were considered the most trusted sources of information about COVID-19 vaccines. Okay, well, we continue to get more information about how well vaccines work. This also from Medical Express. Delta variant makes COVID-19 vaccine even more important, even if you've already had the coronavirus. A growing problem is that people who were previously infected by strains present earlier in the pandemic may be more susceptible to reinfection from the Delta variant. One recent study found that 12 months after infection, 88% of people still had antibodies that could block infection of cultured cells by the original coronavirus variant, but fewer than 50% had antibodies that could block the Delta variant. For those who had already been infected with the coronavirus, there is still a big benefit to getting vaccinated. A study with the original COVID-19 virus showed that vaccination after infection produces roughly 100 times more antibodies than infection alone, and 100% of people who were vaccinated after infection had protective antibodies against the Delta variant. The COVID-19 vaccines aren't perfect, but they produce strong antibody and T-cell responses that offer a safer and more reliable means of protection than natural immunity, especially with the new variants on the loose. And along those same lines from Medical Express, COVID antibodies from vaccination are almost 3 times higher than from infection. People who have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19 have a much stronger immune system response against the new coronavirus than those who've previously been infected, according to a new study. Vaccinated individuals had the highest antibody levels, nearly 3 times higher than that of convalescent individuals recovering from symptomatic COVID-19, an Israeli team reported. These findings might encourage people who believe they're already well protected because of a prior encounter with SARS-CoV-2 to go ahead and get vaccinated, one expert said. This is an encouraging study that further confirms that vaccination against COVID-19 provides a stronger immune response than recovering from infection, said COVID-19 expert Dr. Eric Pena, who directs Global Health at Northwell Health in New Hyde Park, New York. He was not involved in the new research. And one last COVID-19 story, this also from Medical Express. Staff size, COVID-19 outcomes linked at skilled nursing facilities. At skilled nursing facilities, staff size, including staff members not involved in resident care, is strongly associated with COVID-19 outcomes, according to a study published in Health Affairs. Skilled nursing facilities in the lowest quartile of staff size had 6.2 resident cases and 0.9 deaths per 100 beds, while those in the highest quartile had 11.9 resident cases and 2.1 deaths per 100 beds. So this is about a twofold difference. The researchers found that even after accounting for facility size, there was a strong correlation for staff size, including staff members not involved in resident care, with a skilled nursing facility's COVID-19 outcomes. Conventional measures of staffing quality, including direct care staff-to-resident ratios and skill mix, did not significantly predict COVID-19 cases or deaths. Moving forward, policymakers should encourage policies that promote the use of full-time and more consistent staff while maintaining sufficient direct caregivers to provide safe and effective care for residents, the authors write. So, a lot of it just comes down to how many people you're around. Okay, folks, well, it's time for the local COVID-19 update. It's happening. The wave is rising. If you look at the little red dots all over the U.S. map, it looks like we have chickenpox again, and the epicenter is Missouri, and the waves are coming our way, and you can see the red and orange coming right up to Northwest Ohio. So, we're seeing that here in Lucas County. We reached a low a week or so ago of three or four cases per day on a 7-day average. We're back up to 11, which is where we were about a month ago. But Lucas County as a whole is faring better than the state as a whole. Regarding testing positivity rates over the last couple weeks, it has reversed trends and continuing to go up at 1.7%. Not real high, but the testing volume is rising substantially. In other words, more people are seeking testing. The percent positivity rate for the state has about doubled in the last couple weeks from 1.2% to 2.3%. So the trends are definitely in the wrong directions. Regarding nursing homes, we've maintained it around 3 active cases, 1 resident, 2 staff in the most recent week. So keeping it at a low level, but haven't eliminated it yet. Hospitalizations are rising steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio. In the last 10 days, we've had about a 50% rise in hospitalizations in Ohio and a 100% raise or a doubling in Northwest Ohio. It is coming. Nationally, deaths are about 250 per day, and this is slowly but steadily rising. And again, this turns out at this rate, if it were to stay steady, about 90,000 deaths per year, which would be a terrible, terrible flu season. Normally, we get around low teens, like 15,000 up to around 80,000 per flu season year. So 80,000 be a terrible year, and that would exceed it. Okay, vaccinations seem to be sluggishly going along. The U.S. has reached 56% of the population with at least one dose, although I'd remind you that one dose is not enough to give you good protection against the new Delta variant. This 56% is only increasing about a half a percent per week. Ohio's at 48.5% and Lucas County's at 47.6%, and these are decreasing even more slowly. Lucas County is increasing its vaccination rate by less than 0.3% per week. At this rate, we're basically plateauing. We're not going to be in very good shape by the time we get to flu season in the fall. Hopefully, we can bring this increase that's happening now to level off and even come down so we're not in terrible shape going into flu season in October. Okay, well, you're listening to WAKT We Act Radio, 106.1 FM Toledo. This is Just for the Health of It. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's spend the last half of the show with non-COVID news. This from Medical Express. Alcohol consumption linked to more than 740,000 new cancer deaths worldwide in 2020. 4% of newly diagnosed cancer cases in 2020 may be associated with drinking alcohol, according to a global study published in The Lancet Oncology, leading its authors to call for greater public awareness of the link between alcohol and cancers and increase government interventions to reduce alcohol consumption in the worst affected regions. The study estimates that men accounted for 77% of alcohol-associated cancer deaths, compared to women who accounted for 23% of cases. Cancers of the esophagus, liver, and breast accounted for the largest number of cases related to alcohol. Alcohol consumption has been shown to cause DNA damage through increased production of harmful chemicals in the body and affect hormone production, which can contribute to cancer development. Alcohol can also worsen the cancer-causing effects of other substances, such as tobacco. Risky drinking and heavy drinking led to the largest proportion of cancer cases at 39% and 47% respectively. However, moderate drinking was also found to be problematic, with estimates that this level of drinking accounted for 14% of the total of alcohol-caused cases. It seems that there is no safe use of alcohol, and that's pretty much proportional to the use. Okay, and more drug-related news, this from the New York Times. Overdose deaths have surged during the pandemic, CDC data shows. More than 87,000 Americans died of drug overdoses over the 12-month period that ended in September, according to preliminary federal data, eclipsing the toll from any year since the opioid epidemic began in the 1990s. The surge represents an increasingly urgent public health crisis, one that has drawn less attention and fewer resources while the nation has battled the coronavirus pandemic. Deaths from overdoses started rising again in the months leading up to the coronavirus pandemic, after dropping slightly in 2018 for the first time in decades. And it's hard to gauge just how closely the two phenomena are linked, but the pandemic unquestionably exacerbated the trend, which grew much worse late last spring. The biggest jump in overdose deaths took place in April and May, when fear and stress were rampant, job losses were multiplying, and the strictest lockdown measures were in effect. Many treatment programs closed during that time, at least temporarily, and drop-in centers that provide support, clean syringes, and naloxone, the life-saving medication that reverses overdoses, cut back services that in many cases have yet to be fully restored. The preliminary data released last week by the CDC shows a 29% rise in overdose deaths from October 2019 through September 2020, the most recent data available, compared with the previous 12-month period. Illicitly manufactured fentanyl and other synthetic opioids were the primary drivers, although many fatal overdoses have involved stimulant drugs, particularly methamphetamine. And, unlike in the early years of the opioid epidemic, when deaths were largely among white Americans in rural and suburban areas, the current crisis is affecting black Americans disproportionately. The highest increase in mortality from opioids, predominantly driven by fentanyl, is now among black Americans, Dr. Nora Volko, the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, said at a national addiction conference last week. And when you look at mortality from methamphetamine, it's chilling to realize that the risk of dying from methamphetamine overdose is 12-fold higher among American Indians and Alaskan Natives than other groups. Dr. Volko added that more deaths than ever involve drug combinations, typically of fentanyl or heroin with stimulants. Dealers are lacing these non-opioid drugs with cheaper, yet potent opioids to make a larger profit, she said. Someone who's addicted to a stimulant drug, like cocaine or methamphetamine, is not tolerant to opioids, which means they are going to be at high risk of overdose if they get a stimulant drug that's laced with an opioid like fentanyl. The data points corroborate something I believe, which is that people who were already using drugs starting using in ways that were at higher risk, especially using alone and from a less reliable supply. And on the Ohio front, this from the Columbus Dispatch, as feared, Ohio smashes record for drug overdose deaths last year. The toll of fatal drug overdoses last year hit Ohio even worse than initially thought. New figures from the CDC showed this. The agency projected Ohio to hit 5,215 drug deaths, fourth in the U.S. for the nation's seventh largest state, breaking the record of over 4,800 set in 2017. The CDC warned that the 2020 figure will grow. The current total is regarded as underreported due to incomplete data. In 2014, Ohio led the country in overdose deaths, although the 2020 total is some 2.5 times higher than 2014. The new numbers did contain a silver lining for Ohio. The state's increase in drug deaths from 2019, a whopping 17%, was still better than the increase in 34 states. Guess it's always good news to do less bad. Okay, next up, a couple interesting stories about HIV, this from Medical Express. Life expectancy gap closes dramatically between those with HIV and the general population. An observational cohort study finds the mortality among persons entering HIV care decreased dramatically between 1999 and 2017, with the largest decrease seen between 2011 and 2017. Those entering HIV care remained at modestly higher risk for death in the years after starting care than comparable persons in the U.S. general population. The findings are published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. HIV-related mortality has been decreasing since the introduction of effective treatment in 1996 due to improving treatment options and evolving care guidelines, but the extent to which persons entering HIV care in the United States have a higher risk for death over the years after linkage to care than their peers in the general population over the same time period remains unclear. The researchers found the difference in mortality between people with HIV and the general population decreased over time from 11% among those entering care between 1999 and 2004 to 2.7% among those entering care from 2011 to 2017. Of note, mortality decreased across all demographic subgroups studied and decreased more among non-Hispanic black people than non-Hispanic white people. That's unusual. Woohoo! Finally, good to see that for a change. That's a trend that's hard to buck, where blacks don't suffer more than whites for almost every health problem. According to the authors, the decrease in mortality among persons with HIV likely reflects the advancement in treatment and care. New guidelines indicating earlier treatment, greater engagement in care, higher levels of viral suppression, and a trend towards linking persons with HIV to care earlier in the course of infection. Okay, and a second HIV story. This one's less hopeful. This also from Medical Express. People living with HIV/AIDS have a significantly higher risk of suicide. A new study by researchers at Penn State College of Medicine indicates that people living with HIV and AIDS, approximately 38 million worldwide, are more likely to have suicidal thoughts and die from suicide than members of the general population. The researchers said that despite significant medical advancement related to HIV treatment and patients' quality of life, risk of suicide in these patients is high, and healthcare providers should prioritize mental health screenings in this population. Analyzing data from more than 185,000 adults living with HIV or AIDS worldwide, the researchers examined risk factors and incidences of attempted and completed suicides among this population. They found that not only is suicidal ideation higher, but people living with HIV or AIDS were 100 times more likely to die by suicide compared to the general population. Let me repeat that. People living with HIV or AIDS were 100 times more likely to die by suicide compared to the general population. According to the findings, people living with HIV or AIDS in North America are 50 times more likely to commit suicide compared to those living in Europe. Similarly, North America, South America, and Australia have the highest rates of suicide attempts in people living with HIV or AIDS. The researchers also found that the risk of suicide was high for both newly diagnosed individuals and those whose illness progressed to AIDS. The researchers noted that several possible factors may contribute to the increased risk of suicide among people living with HIV or AIDS, including advanced disease, neurological changes, and societal stigmas. On the other hand, data from the study showed that patients being treated with antiviral therapy were less likely to commit suicide. The researcher said the study reveals the importance of mental health screenings and interventions for people living with HIV/AIDS. Okay, well, let's stick a little good news in there. This from Medical Express. 1999 to 2019 saw a drop in rate of unintentional drowning deaths. From 1999 to 2019, there was a 38% decrease in the rate of unintentional drowning deaths among children, according to July data brief published by the CDC and their National Center for Health Statistics. I would note that earlier reported that this is largely due to changes around pool safety. I know when I was a kid, there was a lot of pools that wouldn't even have fences around. Now most communities require that you have fences and gates and locks and that type of thing to keep small children from wandering in the pool. It makes a difference. Okay, and speaking of children, this from Science Daily. Evidence against physically punishing kids is clear, researchers say. A conclusive narrative review has found physical punishment of children is not effective in preventing child behavior problems or promoting positive outcomes, and instead predicts increases in behavior problems and other poor outcomes over time. The study by an international group of scientists, including a researcher from the University of Texas at Austin, was published in The Lancet. Caregivers in many parts of the world use physical punishment as a response to a child's perceived misbehavior. 63% of children between the ages of 2 and 4 worldwide, approximately 250 million children, are regularly subjected to physical punishment by caregivers. 62 countries have banned the practice, which is increasingly seen as a form of violence. The team looked at studies involving physical punishment such as spanking and excluded any behaviors that could constitute child physical abuse. The researchers found ample evidence to support a United Nations statement from the Committee on the Rights of the Child that recommended countries end the use of all types of physical punishment on children. There is no evidence that physical punishment is good for children, said Elizabeth Gershoff, who is the Amy Johnson McLaughlin Centennial Professor in Human Development and Family Sciences at the University of Texas at Austin, the senior author of the paper. All the evidence indicates that physical punishment is harmful to children's development and well-being. In the U.S., it is legal in all 50 states for parents to use physical punishment. It is also legal in 19 states for schools to use physical punishment against children. The paper was intended as a resource for policymakers and people who work with families, such as medical and mental health providers. This is a public health issue, said Anya Heilman, lead author of the paper, who is an associate professor at University College London. Given the strength of the evidence that physical punishment has the potential to cause harm to children, policymakers have a responsibility to protect children and legislate to end the use of physical punishment in all settings. Gershoff previously authored a landmark 2016 meta-analysis of dozens of studies and found that physical punishment was not associated with any positive outcomes for children and was heavily associated with a variety of negative outcomes. Gershoff's work was cited by former Secretary of Education John King Jr. in a 2016 federal letter urging states to consider ending the use of physical punishment in schools. Kirchhoff also helped to inform policy statements from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Psychological Association that use research on the harmful effects of physical punishment as a basis for recommending that caregivers no longer use it. Okay, and another study on youth is from Medical Express. Self-inflicted firearm injury three times more common in rural youth. A national study published in the Journal of Pediatrics found that emergency department visits by youth for self-harm were nearly 40% higher in rural areas compared to urban settings. Strikingly, emergency department visits by youth for self-inflicted firearm injuries were three times more common in rural areas. Youth from rural areas presenting to the emergency department for suicidal ideation or self-harm also are more likely to need to be transferred to another hospital for care, which underscores the insufficient mental health resources in rural hospitals. Dr. Hoffman, the author of the study, explains that a number of factors contribute to higher suicide rates and self-harm in rural areas. Access to mental health care is a huge challenge, she says. Shortages of pediatric mental health professionals in rural areas play a significant role, requiring patients to travel long distances for help, which is a barrier for many. Also, lower family income and higher unemployment rates in rural areas may result in poor insurance coverage, especially for mental health. In small towns, there's also concerns with anonymity, which may cause delays in seeking care until a crisis brings a child to the emergency department. Rural families are also more likely to own firearms, so increased access to firearms may account for a high degree of disparity in self-inflicted firearm injuries. We need to improve mental health training for emergency department providers, allocate more resources, and implement policies in rural hospitals on managing young patients who present with suicidal ideation or self-harm, said Dr. Hoffman. More widespread use of telepsychiatry also might help prevent unnecessary transfers to other hospitals. But even more importantly, we need to train primary care providers to help diagnose and treat mental health issues earlier so we can prevent self-inflicted injuries and death. Okay, well, I want to do a follow-up on a continuing story I've been covering, this new Alzheimer's drug Aduhelm. This from Medical Express. Two major health systems won't administer a controversial new Alzheimer's drug. Two major U.S. health systems say they will not administer the controversial new Alzheimer's drug Aduhelm. The decision by the Cleveland Clinic and Mount Sinai's health system in New York City are the latest fallout from the U.S. FDA's widely criticized approval of the Biogen drug on June 7th. Many experts say there's no clear evidence the drug helps slow mental decline in Alzheimer's patients, and the approval has triggered congressional investigations. After an expert panel review of all available scientific evidence on this medication, the Cleveland Clinic has decided not to carry the drug at this time, the clinic said in a statement. Individual doctors can prescribe Aduhelm, but those patients would have to go elsewhere to receive the drug that's administered as a monthly intravenous infusion, the clinic added. In a recent survey of nearly 200 neurologists and primary care doctors, most said they disagreed with the FDA decision and did not plan to prescribe the drug to their patients. Last week, in response to growing criticism, the acting FDA Commissioner, Dr. Janet Woodcock, called for an independent federal investigation into the agency's approval process. To the extent these concerns could undermine the public's confidence in the FDA's decision, I believe it is critical that the events at issue be reviewed by an independent body, she said. And I would note that I made an earlier prediction that while this is a disastrous decision, I think because it's an expensive, complicated drug and a lot of clinicians and even entire clinics and health systems are not even going to administer this drug because they're pretty uncertain about whether it offers any benefit for the incredible costs and side effects and such. So this just further is further evidence that that prediction may be on the low end about how much damage it does to our healthcare system and the people it's supposed to serve.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever. Callus always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I want to close out the show with two food system stories. This first one from Washington Post. The total health and climate consequences of the American food system cost three times as much as the food itself. The U.S. spends $1.1 trillion a year on food, but when the impacts of the food system on different parts of society, including rising healthcare costs, climate change, and biodiversity loss are factored in, the bill is around three times that, according to a report by the Rockefeller Foundation, a private charity that funds medical and agricultural research. Using government statistics, scientific literature, and insights from experts across the food system, the researchers quantified things like the share of direct medical costs attributable to diet and food, as well as the productivity loss associated with those health problems. They also looked at how crop cultivation and ranching and other aspects of the U.S. food production impacted the environment, focusing on the production, processing, distribution, retail, and consumption stages of the food system, not including food service. They evaluated what it would cost to restore people's health, wealth, or environment back to an undamaged state, as well as the cost of preventing a recurrence of the problems. Realizing a better food system requires facing hard facts. We must accurately calculate the full cost we pay for food today to successfully shape economic and regulatory incentives tomorrow, asserts the introduction of the report, written by the Foundation's Food Research Group. Health impacts are the biggest hidden costs of the food system, with more than $1 trillion per year in health-related costs paid by Americans, with an estimated $604 billion of that attributable to diseases, such as hypertension, cancer, and diabetes, linked to diet. In calculating the financial burden of environmental problems, the researchers evaluated direct environmental impacts of farming and ranching on greenhouse gas emissions, water depletion, and soil erosion. They also looked at reduced biodiversity, which lowers ecosystems' productivity and makes food supplies more vulnerable to pests and disease. They determined the unaccounted cost of the food system on the environment and biodiversity add up to almost $900 billion per year. The report examines 14 metrics, health, environment, biodiversity, livelihoods, and more, to quantify what it calls the true cost of food, reflecting additional externalized costs incurred within the food system not covered by the price of food. These externalized costs are being incurred by the public sector, businesses and producers, consumers and future generations, the report argues. Across many of the areas, communities of color bear a disproportionate burden. This report is a wake-up call. The U.S. food system as it stands is adversely affecting our environment, our health, and our society, said Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation. To fix a problem, we need to first understand its extent. The data in this report reveals not only the negative impacts of the food system in America, but also what steps we can take to make it more equitable, resilient, and nourishing. If an organic apple is 99 cents and a sugary beverage is also 99 cents, there are layers of subsidies in that sugary beverage. We need to examine not only what we're paying, but what that price reflects, the subsidized costs and the external costs, diabetes, obesity. You can quantify the health impact, she said. Dariush Mozafarian, Dean of Tufts University School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy, who was an advisor on the report, said that the pandemic, coupled with the Black Lives Matter and the reawakening around racial justice, has been a, quote, September 11th moment around food. We're at a tipping point. People widely recognize that the food system is broken, adding the most current public policies around food and agriculture are based on the 1969 White House Conference on Food, Nutrition, and Health. Yet 52 years later, much of it doesn't make sense. The priority in the 1950s was to get calories into the world because the world population had quadrupled. At the same time, the best nutrition information we had was about vitamins. Vitamin deficiency have largely disappeared. We were successful, but we didn't anticipate the explosion of obesity, he said. According to the report, if U.S. rates of diet-related diseases were reduced to similar rates in countries like Canada, healthcare costs could be reduced by $250 billion per year. This would require the food industry to focus on creating healthier foods and adhering to more rigorous regulations for the marketing of unhealthy foods, said Roy Steiner, Senior Vice President of the Food Initiative at Rockefeller Foundation. We created the food system with a particular objective, low cost and abundant calories, and we didn't understand what that impact was going to be, said Steiner. Separately, the report also suggested the U.S. could reduce agricultural greenhouse gas emissions to keep the global temperature increase below 1.5 degrees centigrade of pre-industrial levels, then some $100 billion could be saved in additional environmental costs. Melissa Ho, a senior vice president of the World Wildlife Fund and also an advisor on the report, said that while people are increasingly aware of the connection between diet and health, they have trouble understanding the connection between the food system and environmental damage. She would like to see more performance-based metrics and tools to assess things like how much carbon a farmer or rancher is returning to the soil. We must shift our farming practices and systems to be more regenerative and resilient. We can do this if we realign and shift our public policies and programs to support producers and drive this transition from the ground up, she said. Based on the way the system is set up right now, she said, it's not easy or lucrative for farmers to transition to less harmful agricultural practices, such as not tilling or using cover crops that help build soil and prevent erosion. COVID exposed so much that was broken, she said. But building back better means supporting producers and connecting the dots to health, environment, and business viability for farmers. This last story, I want to take it all the way back to the wisdom of indigenous peoples. This from the FAO. FAO report maps insights from and threats to indigenous peoples' food systems. Collaborative studies look at 8 indigenous peoples' food systems in Amazon, Sahel, Himalayas, Pacific Islands, and Arctic, documenting unique capacity to conserve biodiversity and foster resilient food security and calls for recognizing land rights and traditional practices. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the FAO, released a new study identifying hundreds of diverse plants and animal species that indigenous peoples around the world depend on and care for to generate food sustainably and enhance biodiversity, and warning of increasing threats to these sophisticated food systems. The report, titled Indigenous Peoples Food Systems, Insights of Sustainability and Resilience from the Frontline of Climate Change, was launched last Friday. We must work with them to learn and co-create knowledge for all of humanity. Nearly 500 million people in more than 90 countries self-identify as indigenous, with unique traditional knowledge offering rich opportunities for food security and biosecurity preservation. 8 indigenous peoples' food systems were examined in depth and revealed to be among the most sustainable in the world in terms of efficiency, no waste, seasonality, and reciprocity. They generate hundreds of food items from the environment without depleting natural resources and achieve high levels of self-sufficiency. In the Solomon Islands, for example, the Malaysian people combine agroforestry, wild food gathering, and fishing to generate 70% of their dietary needs. In Finland's Arctic region, through fishing, hunting, and herding, the Inari Sami people generate 75% of the protein they consume. Today, these systems are at high risk from climate change and the expansion of various industrial and commercial activities. Despite surviving for centuries, indigenous peoples' agri-food systems are likely to disappear in the next years due to the number of drivers threatening their futures, highlighted Juan Lucas Restrepo, Director General of the Alliance for Biodiversity International. Researchers must listen and learn from them to support efforts to maintain ancestral knowledge, he added. Being adaptive is the main resilient element in these food systems. Indigenous peoples adapt their food generation and consumption to the seasonality and natural cycles observed in their surrounding ecosystems, not in the opposite way as most other societies do. Deep observation of the environment accumulated generation after generation and sharp understanding of the relationships between the elements in the ecosystem guarantee the protection of biodiversity, said Anne Nuargam, chair of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Indigenous peoples' food systems are game changers if acknowledged and protected, as recent studies have also shown that in several areas zero hunger has been achieved. We need more effective and creative interactions between indigenous knowledge and scientific knowledge systems. This is the only way we will achieve the agri-food system transformation that the world needs. In the current COVID-19 context, indigenous peoples able to rely on their traditional food systems to generate food are coping better than other communities who rely on the market for their food needs. Okay, well, last up, the bonus articles that you can read online for some more in-depth coverage. I'll give you the link at the end. 6 articles today. Delta is driving a wedge through Missouri. For America as a whole, the pandemic might be fading. For some communities, this year will be worse than last. 2, is your office safe from COVID? What to know now that your boss wants you back? 3, old people in prison were left to die from COVID. It didn't have to be that way. Now the vaccine could offer states an excuse not to release anyone. 4, COVID risks at the Tokyo Olympics aren't being managed, experts say. 5. Frequently asked questions about biosecure labs and the work researchers conduct. 6. Vaccine hesitancy morphs into hostility as opposition to shots hardens. You can get links to these and all the other stories I reported on today and all from previous shows as well by going to toppun.com/blog, W-A-K-T. That's toppun.com/blog/W-A-K-T. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-